The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. So let's start off this session with a really serious, serious piece. Life Well Lived. Life advice from a five-year-old. Stressed? Overwhelmed? Maybe donuts, dinosaurs, and Dolly Parton can help. And there's an illustration left that shows a drawing of a girl with a pretty red lips and all kinds of hearts all over the thing. And it's the saying in there, it says, "You got to say your affirmations in your mouth and your heart." And next to that is a picture of a pink donut with sprinkles. It says, "Think about the donuts of your day." And then down in the left-hand corner, there's a thing with it shows a drawing of a small, smelly creature with a white stripe down its black back, and never put a skunk on a bus. And then there's one with a drawing of Dolly Parton on the back of a dinosaur. It says, "Like Dolly on a dinosaur." When Gwyneth Toadbush told her five-year-old son, Clark, that she was feeling anxious about a meeting, he knew he could help. "Mama, I am nervous all the time. I know what to do." What followed was a stream of uplifting advice through a five-year-old's filter. Gwyneth posted their exchange on Twitter, and it went viral. "Everybody is kind of coping with one kind of stress or another in a pandemic," says Gwyneth, who lives in northern Michigan. "I think it rang true with people," I said on Twitter, "that he's the only life coach I know that gets paid in goldfish crackers." Here's Clark advised, followed by a brief explanation from his mother. "You gotta say your affirmations in your mouth and your heart." Another mom on Twitter talked about saying affirmations with their kid before school. "We tried it. Sometimes I tell him, 'Say it like you mean it.'" I guess he translated that. "You say, 'I am brave of this meeting. I am loved. I smell good.'" He knows you can be scared of something. So he talks about being brave of things. I love the grammatical construction. I've never corrected it because I like it better. I don't know where the "I smell good" came up, but I like it. I'm going to use it a lot. "You gotta walk big. You gotta mean it. Like Dolly on a dinosaur, because you got it." He really loves Dolly Parton's coat of many colors. When kids are making fun of her in school, she still went in and was brave and talks to those kids. I don't know where the dinosaur thing come from. "Never put a skunk on a bus." I don't know what this has to do with being nervous. "Think about the donuts of your day." We used to go to this little record shop. There was a room in the back and a whole section of records for a dollar. I would take him in there with a dollar bill, and he came back with a Burl Ives record of the 50s. There's a song on there called Donut Song. It goes, "Watch the donut, not the hole." After we listened to that song a lot, that became our thing. Every night at bed, he tells me about the donuts of his day. Even if you cry a little, you can think about potato chips. When he's upset, sometimes I tell him to think about things he's looking forward to. Potato chips are very high on the list. Even if a yucky day, you can get a hug. There have been so many times when there's nothing I can do. I tell him, even if it's a bad day, when you get home, I'll hug you. Clark didn't have other kids around during the pandemic, Gwyneth says, so she's been working with him to make a transition to school easier. Affirmations helped, though she didn't realize how much until Clark offers his own version of them. Told you it was serious. Best Pet Pals, Oscar the Rooster. And there's a picture of a really handsome-looking chicken, all red and orange and yellow with a red cock on his head and a black and white tail. We were all confused when a rooster showed up at our suburban senior community, considering there are no farms nearby. The colorful bird strutted from porch to porch for corn and other goodies from generous neighbors, and then roosted in the trees at night. One neighbor, Richard, became especially close with the rooster, named Oscar by the neighbors. Richard has lingering PTSD from military service, and spending time outside with Oscar notably improved his outlook. Then disaster struck. Richard was hospitalized, and while he was away, the township took Oscar. When Richard returned, he was crushed to find his friend gone. He went to the animal shelter to spring him, but there was a hefty fee for Oscar's relief. 2 days later, I heard a familiar cock-a-doodle-doo, and Oscar had reappeared. We're not sure how our jailbird was sprung, but we suspect a neighbor bailed him out. Every time I hear Oscar crow, I'm grateful that Rich's life is a bit more livable, thanks to Oscar's company. nominated by Lois Gilho. Everyday Miracles, a gem of a proposal. And there's a drawing here of a man, looks like he's panning for gold, and there's a young woman with a backpack standing in front of him. And it's just a kind of a country-looking western kind of thing with pine trees in the background. Christian London was in the eighth grade when he hatched a grandiose plan to create a personal engagement ring from his future fiancée. Never mind that he didn't even have a girlfriend. If a natural diamond could take billions of years to form, he figured he could be patient. Linda decided he would not pick out a ring in a jeweler's case like most other people. Instead, he would go into the wild to find his own materials, the diamond, the gold, the accompanying gemstones, everything. I've always been a rock hound, so to me, this is the perfect way to get an engagement ring, said Lyndon, who lives in Paluspo, Washington, near Seattle. Actually, it's the only way. I couldn't imagine not making it myself. Last year, Lyndon decided, it's L-I-D-E-N, I'm going to say his name is Lyndon, decided it was finally time to put his plan into action. He and his girlfriend, Desiree Clockevold, had been together for more than 5 years. I knew that I wanted to marry her, and I also wanted to surprise her, says Lyndon, who works for his family's excavating business. So in May 2021, Lyndon told Clockevold, that's K-L-O-K-K-E-V-O-L-D, interesting name, he and Josh Tucker, his best friend since the sixth grade, were heading out on a camping trip to Yellowstone. He and Tucker made their way instead to the Crater of Diamonds State Park in Murfreesboro, Arkansas, which is set on an eroded volcano crater. The park is one of the few places in the world where the public is welcome to search for real diamonds and keep what they find. About 33,000 diamonds have been found at Crater of Diamonds since it opened in 1972. Most are fairly small. Only 1 in 10,000 park visitors is lucky enough to find a diamond that weighs more than a carat or more. Lyndon knew that the odds of finding anything spectacular were minuscule. Still, he was up for the challenge. He had started panning for gold around his home state years earlier, and now had enough to make the ring band. On the way to Crater of Diamonds, Lyndon and Tucker had stopped at Helena, Montana, to mine for sapphires. They found a couple of small beauties to add to the diamond they hoped to secure. In Arkansas, the pair paid $10 each to get into the park and got to work. They spent almost 3 days sifting through the volcanic dirt. On the third morning, Lyndon suddenly spotted something reflecting light in the gravel on the shifting screen, a shiny pebble a bit larger than a pea. I was so excited that I started shaking, and I called Josh over to take a look. Tucker let out a whoop when he saw the stone. It was oily and shiny, and we both just knew it was a diamond, he says. We freaked out a little bit. We couldn't believe it. The two quickly took the find to the park office, where it was confirmed that Lyndon had found a 2.2-carat triangular yellow diamond. Similar-sized diamonds go for $2,500 to $20,000 per carat, depending on the color, cut, and clarity. But the value wasn't what was important to Lyndon. To me, it was priceless. I had found Desiree's diamond. When he returned to Polesboro, Lyndon confessed to his girlfriend that he hadn't been in Yellowstone. Then I pulled out the diamond and got on my knee, he says. I told Desiree that I'd like to design a ring for her if she'd marry me. She was stunned. I knew that he was going to propose someday, Clockevold says, but I certainly didn't expect this. And she said yes. We found a fix. Help, hacks, and how to. Number one, preserving your herbs. And there's a picture of an ice cube tray with a bunch of green stuff inside it. Once you have a nice dinner on the table, it's difficult to predict when you'll be up to such gourmet cooking again. But don't let those handfuls of chopped rosemary, oregano, thyme, and dill go to waste. Freeze the leftover herbs and olive oil in an ice cube tray. Then while warming a pan for your next piece of de resistance, toss in a cube or two to melt. The herb-olive oil mixture will leave the pan both lubricated and seasoned. Number two, turn gift cards into savings. No matter how bad do you want something, it's hard not to dip into the money you keep setting aside. To make sure those funds stay untouched, buy and save gift cards until you have the amount you need. Want a new laptop? Throw down an Apple gift card. Need a dishwasher? Put on your extra cash into Hope Depot gift cards. This way you can't dip into your shiny new object fund. You may be motivated to save even faster if the cards have expiration dates. Number three, travel. Plan green plane trips. Want to be kind to the earth while seeing every corner of it? Search on Google Flights and use the Any Emissions filter to see how many kilograms of carbon dioxide are emitted by each available flight based on the flight plan, aircraft, and number of seats in each class. You can even filter by low emissions only to see the greenest flights available. Number 4, home. Magnetize a screwdriver. The next time you go to war with an IKEA table, place a small magnet on the metal parts of your screwdriver. Screws will automatically attach to the tip of the screwdriver, so you won't have to hold each screw in place with one hand while you twist the screwdriver handle with the other. It'll make a complicated project much easier. Scramble your passwords, not your brain. Number 5. The best passwords are so good, so unguessable, that everyone, sometimes even you apparently, gets locked out. Instead of using something obvious, no pet names, or going through the hassle of password recovery, try this trick that cybersecurity experts recommend. Choose a short phrase, lyric, or quote that you'll remember. Then swap in numbers and symbols that resemble the letters. For example, rewrite No Place Like Home as N0PLAMERASPIRAND CE-L1K3-HO-3. It'll still be memorable, but a lot more secure. For even further security, refrain from making that lyric or quote your Facebook status. That makes sense. I guess that's all we're going to do. We're only going to do 5 of them today. Usually do more. How to learn a language as an adult. Contrary to conventional thinking, it isn't too late. For more than 2 years, Dulce Schoner of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, had done daily German lessons on her smartphone. To some, that mound sounded like self-imposed homework, but to Schoner, a language lover and the copy chief for the Reader's Digest and other publications, doesn't see it that way. I enjoy it so much, she says. It's a delight to be able to read a short story in German. I'm going to say something personal here. I took German in college, and just about the time I learned to actually read it, I was out of college, and I haven't done anything else since. Kafka is definitely different in German than it is in English. To be able to read, write, or carry on a conversation in another language is a feat few Americans attempt, let alone achieve. Just 7% of our university students study a language other than English, and less than 1% of American adults are proficient in a foreign language they studied in school. Of her college German, Schoner says, I remembered very little, all I can identify with that. Yet the rewards for those who do learn a second or third or fourth language are profound. Increased travel opportunities, of course, but also improved memory, focus, and the ability to multitask. Bilingual brains are better shielded against cognitive disorders such as Alzheimer's disease. And according to a poll conducted by the language app Babel, you know, knowing multiple languages can make you seem more attractive. So why aren't more of us multilingual or trying to be? There are dozens of recent answers to that question, but one common retort is, doesn't have much merit at all. The idea that adults, especially older ones, just can't learn languages as easily as children can. Linguists have long debated how old is too old to acquire a language, but newer research is refuting the idea wholesale. There is no magical point at which it becomes impossible to learn a new language, says Allison Gabriel, Ph.D., of the University of Kansas, who published a study last year, showing that adult learners, even as beginners, could process sentence structures in new languages much like native speakers. Separate research at Cambridge University recently found that language instruction affects adults and children the same way. While it is true that children tend to pick up new languages quickly and easily, this has more to do with how they learn than how old they are when they do. Kids absorb and infer lots of information about language simply by listening. To family, friends, teachers, and the media around them, it happens without much thought or effort on their part. And when they do put in effort, it's because they want to understand the story, joke, or game that's going on. By contrast, adults tend to learn in rigid academic settings, where they have little to say in what they study and where the stakes are also higher. What Schoner can recall from her German classes is the pressure to maintain her grade point average. Wow, I remember that. I was horrified of making mistakes, she says. No, I'm not afraid, and I know I'm doing better than I did in college. If you dream of being bilingual, your age does not qualify you. Make the process more fun, and by extension, more successful with these tips. Find your motivation. Wish you had paid more attention in high school Spanish? Consider why you didn't. Perhaps all you wanted out of the class was a good grade or to fulfill a graduation requirement. Linguists call these incentives intrinsic motivators. But the most successful language students are intrinsically motivated students. Motivated since sincerely invested in their own learning. So pick a language you are excited to use, whether on a grand vacation in Spain or on your couch watching Spanish soap operas. Pick your tools. It might take some trial and error, but you'll figure out which resources work best for you. Mobile apps such as Duolingo and Babbel gamify your learning, so you could easily spend hours playing on your phone. You'll likely find these similarly addictive. Others such as Rosetta Stone and Pensulaire are less gimmicky, but more rigorously researched. Consider a conversation-based class on Italki or Idlewild, and don't neglect books. McGraw-Hill and Barron's offer excellent textbooks, grammar guides, and workbooks with answer keys to let you see how you're doing. But you may enjoy children's stories more with their simple vocabulary and easy-to-understand narratives. Dive in. Immerse yourself in your chosen language as much as you can. Watch movies or listen to songs, even if they are just on in the background. Periodically look around you and see how many things you can name in the language you're studying. Or better yet, label items around your home with those words. You'll have no choice but to see them and in very little time learn them. Get social. Practicing with other people helps solidify what you've already learned and makes you more aware of which ideas you're able to express. These need not be native speakers you can chat with, though various websites and apps such as LanguageExchange.com, HelloTalk, and TalkAbroad can connect you with some, either free or for a small fee. And don't sweat your mistakes. Kids get it wrong all the time. They'll say, for instance, that they gooed to school and played with other childs. But inherent in these errors is an understanding of the general rules. We use ed as a suffix to put an action in the past, and we add s to make things plural, and so on. Although kids often misapply these rules, they pick up on the patterns and use them in novel situations. This is what successful language learners do. Sometimes you'll miss the mark as you unknowingly stumble on an irregular verb or an exception to the rule. But more often you'll be right, and even when you do falter, those who are fluent should still be able to understand what you mean. Try less. It seems counterintuitive, but you're more receptive to pick up on language patterns when you aren't hyper-focused on learning them. So rather than stare intently at a vocabulary list, glance over the words while you listen to instrumental music. I need to study my English here. Or enjoy a glass of wine ahead of the conversation practice. As research at the University of Liverpool has shown, our ability to speak a second language improves after a bit of alcohol. Oh, that's good. Or turn on subtitles in the language you're learning, even as you watch TV in English. But don't devote your full attention to them. Just enjoy the show and absorb what you can. The less you stress, the more you'll be able to learn. Kids today will never know the annoyance of calling your friend and having to ask to speak to them. The joy of being selected to go outside and dust the erasers. The rush of the internet finally connecting on that third dialing attempt. And having to wait 15 minutes for a short thing to load. Now here's an interesting article. How 11 iconic stores got their names. 7-Eleven was originally totem stores. Piggly Wiggly was inspired by actual pigs. Here's the fascinating history behind your favorite spots to shop and their iconic names. CVS. In 1963, brothers Stanley and Sidney Goldstein and their business partner Ralph Hoagland opened their first customer value stores in Lowell, Massachusetts. In 1964, the acronym CVS appeared for the first time in the company's first logo, which featured the name Consumer Value Stores, parked by a pair of shields with the letters inside. Over time, the shorter acronym replaced the original name altogether, and one of the most recent CEOs has claimed that the re-letters could also stand for convenience, value, and service. Think it's weird that this poppy store basically changed its name, its acronym? How about Piggly Wiggly? Back in 1916, a young wholesale food salesman named Clarence Saunders was taking a trip from Indiana to Tennessee by train. At this time, self-service grocery stores were non-existent. Customers still had to tell a grocer everything they wanted and wait at a counter to receive it. Saunders had traveled to Indiana to inspect a grocery store there in hopes of finding some information that would help it boost his own business. But the trip had been a bust, or so he thought, until the train slowed down next to a farm. Saunders glimpsed a sow standing in the field surrounded by six feeding piglets, and suddenly the answer came to him. In his book, Elastic, Leonard Moldoy described Saunders' epiphany. The piglets were serving themselves. Why not let humans do the same? Human customers help themselves. The simple visual of hungry piglets gave Saunders everything he needed to open the first self-service grocery store, and he named it in the pig's honor, Piggly Wiggly. 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven began as an ice company, which is kind of poetic considering that its most famous offer today is a frozen slush drink. In the late 1920s, an employee began selling food out of one location, and its notoriety began to grow. Customers began calling it the Totem Store because of the way they toted their purchase out of the store. That name stuck until 1946, when management decided to change it to reflect the store's new hours, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. IKEA. Unlike the names of many of its products, IKEA's name isn't a Swedish word. It's actually an acronym from the furniture giant's founder, who was only 17 years old at the time, came up with. The young entrepreneur, Ingvar Kamprad, took his own initials and combined them with the first letter of his old home. Kamprad held from a farm called Elmtjad, located in the Swedish village of Agunnjad, hence the E and the A for IKEA. Walmart. Walmart began as Walton's 5 and 10, a small-town store in Bentonville, Arkansas, owned by and named after Sam Walton. In 1955, Walton would hire a man named Bob Bogle to manage the 5 and 10 so that Walton could focus on expanding and opening more variety stores. In 1962, Walton realized the heyday of small variety stores was coming to an end and decided to open a larger discount store. Boy, he sure didn't hear about dollar stores today. Before that first store opened in Rogers, Arkansas, it was Bogle who decided to combine the first syllable of founder's name with Mart. Walmart Discount City was officially on the map. In 2017, the company chose to nix the hyphen as a symbol of oneness, and they wanted the company with its name to convey. Walmart's president and CEO Doug McMillon shared, "Whether it's in our stores, on our sites, with our apps, by using their voice, or whatever comes next, there is one Walmart as far as our customers are concerned." How about Trader Joe's? Trader Joe's. In 1958, a small chain of convenience stores called Pronto's Markets was born in the greater Los Angeles area. Its founder, Joe Colomb, quickly realized that the chain was too similar to the ultra-successful 7-Eleven and couldn't realistically compete with it. Inspired by the Polynesian-themed restaurant, Trader Vic's, he launched the chain, but this time with his own name on it. He followed Trader Vic's lead and dressed his employees in Hawaiian garb. Colomb also realized that selling unique foods that were all but impossible to find at other grocery stores at that time, such as granola and wine, would help his business boom. Aldi's. This discount store originated in Georgia. I'm sorry. It originated in Germany as the enterprise of two brothers, Carl and Theo Albrecht. They took the first syllable of their surname and paired it with the first symbol of discount to create Aldi. In 1960, the brothers would have a falling out over whether the store should sell cigarettes. When they were unable to resolve this difference of opinion, Aldi split into two separate entities, Aldi Nord and Aldi Sud, meaning North and South. Aldi Sud is the version American shoppers are familiar with, but Aldi Nord is also going strong around the world. Sears. The full name of this department store company is Sears Roebuck & Company. It began in 1880 as a watch retailer founded by entrepreneurial cohorts Richard W. Sears and Alva C. Roebuck. Over time, the Roebuck & Company part of the name faded into relative obscurity, most likely due in part to its removal from storefronts, so that company just became known as Sears. While it may seem like Mr. Roebuck got a raw deal, a Harris poll recently found that Sears is currently America's least favorite retailer, so maybe Roebuck is actually better off. Target, also known to Target among us fans. In 1962, the Dayton Company, a department store franchise, opened up a new mass-market discounter in Roseville, Minnesota. The director of publicity for Dayton, Stuart K. Wittes, pondered whether some 200 potential names for a new company with his team. When Target was suggested, the idea of a red and white bullseye logo immediately burst into existence. Wittes knew he had stumbled on something good. For him, the simple represented how, as a markman's goal is to hit the center bullseye, the new store would do much the same of retail goods, services, commitment to the community, price over value, and overall experience. According to Target's website, Target's logo hasn't changed much over the years. Barnes & Noble. Before Barnes & Noble was the bookstore claiming the largest number of American retail outlets, it was a 19th century bookstore called Hines & Company. Arthur Hines hired a Harvard graduate named Guilford Clifford Noble to work at the store, and Noble would become his business partner. The store's name would change to become Hines & Noble in 1894. Enter the Barnes of this bookseller's name. William Barnes, Barnes's father, a friend of Nobel, had opened the book business out of his Illinois home in the late 1800s. Noble bought out Hines in 1917 to team up with Barnes, and the rest is history. Now that you know why they're called, check out some simple ways to save money at your favorite stores, but we're not going to do that today. We'll do that at another time. Okay, prepare to feast on an irresistible array of food-related facts and scrumptious statistics. Food. Glorious food. We think about it, shop for it, cook it, order it, and hopefully enjoy it. Between all of that, we wouldn't blame you if you never stopped to consider his various food facts. But you should. Not only are they fun, but they help you understand exactly what lands on your plate, its origin, and how your tastes compare to everyone else's. For instance, did you know that only a small fraction of Americans take their coffee black? Or that the age-old Italian crowd pleaser, no pizza, lasagna, actually originated in Greece? Or that McDonald's isn't the oldest fast food restaurant? This smorgasbord of food facts trivia is certainly to beef up your knowledge about the vast topics so many of us are passionate about. Read on for some more surprising food facts, and a few weird ones that will up your trivia game. Bananas are technically berries. It's hard to miss the huge yellow heap of bananas in the produce section at a typical grocery store. Grocers are definitely giving the people what they want because, according to the USDA, bananas top the list of the most popular fresh fruit in America. Well, that may not be a surprising food fact. What may be is that bananas are classified as berries because they come from a single seed. With consumptions at 13.4 pounds per person in America, bananas clearly have plenty of appeal. A-P-E-E-L. Terrible. Watermelons are popular hostess gifts in China. A slice of cold, sweet watermelon is one of summer's greatest pleasures. All the water in melon's pretty pink flesh is sweet and juicy way to stay hydrated. Turns out Americans aren't the only ones who appreciate a watermelon. More than 1,200 varieties are grown in 96 countries around the world. And in terms of production, the United States currently ranks 7th, while China is in first place. Maybe that has something to do with why watermelons are popular hostess gifts in China. McDonald's isn't the oldest fast food chain. For decades, Americans have turned to fast food when they're hungry and on the go. While some people think McDonald's ignited the category in the 50s, the first fast food burger chain was White Castle, which was founded in Kansas in 1921. Around 66% of Americans like their toast lightly toasted. There's a strong preference for lightly toasted toast on breakfast plates. According to a 2019 survey from YouGov, 58% of respondents are in the somewhat lightly toasted camp, while another 8% preferring their bread very lightly toasted. On the other hand, 32% prefer the somewhat to very darkly toasted, and 1% like their toast burnt. No judgments here. Only a fifth of Americans take their morning coffee black. Just 20% of Americans like their coffee black, and another fifth, 19%, don't drink coffee at all. The remaining 60% of coffee drinkers like their cuppa somewhere along the tan spectrum. With milk, very light tan covers 39% of the respondents. With light milk, brown is the preference for another 10%, and with a lot of milk, almost white, rounds things out with 11%. This survey only asked about milk. Sugar is another matter, and iced coffee was not a choice. And with that, we'll switch over to Consumer Reports, and there's a picture of a fork holding spaghetti with sauce and a big fat meatball right on top of it. Looks delicious. On the other page, on the facing page, is the headline, "Is Our Meat Safe to Eat?" CR tested 351 packages of ground meat and found dangerous bacteria in almost a third of the chicken samples we bought, deadly bacteria in ground beef, and worrisome gaps in the way meat is regulated in this country. With grilling season in full swing, here's what you need to know. Americans love meat, especially ground meat. We shape it into burgers, meatloaf, stir it into chili and pasta sauce, and stuff it into peppers, lasagna, and tacos. Americans like it so much that in 2021 alone, we purchased more than $13 billion worth of ground beef, turkey, pork, and chicken. But a love of ground meat comes at a price. It's a leading cause of food poisoning. Since 2018, 11 outbreaks of illness have been traced back to raw meat, sickening and reported 1,264 people. At least 8 of them involved ground meat, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. to assess the current state of the nation's ground meat supply. Consumer Reports recently released 351 packages of ground beef, pork, chicken, and turkey purchased at stores throughout the country. What we found was alarming. Almost a third of the ground chicken packages we tested contained salmonella. We also found those bacteria in a few samples of ground beef, pork, and turkey. Particularly worrisome, every single strain of salmonella was resistant to at least one antibiotic. Sierra also found a strain of E. coli in a sample of ground beef that is so dangerous that we immediately alerted the Department of Agriculture to our findings, triggering a recall of more than 28,000 pounds of meat from a major grocery chain in seven western states. That bacteria should not have been in the meat, period, says James E. Rogers, Ph.D., Director of Food Safety and Research and Testing at CR, and a former official at the USDA. There is zero tolerance policy for that bacteria, and for good reason. It's hard to treat, and it can kill you. Together, the findings highlight serious flaws in the way meat is produced in this country and huge gaps in how the government ensures meat safety. Right now, preventing illness caused by contaminated meat falls too heavily on the shoulders of consumers, not on industry or regulators, Rogers said. It shouldn't be that way, and it doesn't have to be that way. Risky stuff. Ground meat is more likely than whole cuts, such as steaks and chicken breast, to make you sick for several reasons. It starts in a processing plant where the meat from multiple animals is ground together. Even if the meat from just one animal is contaminated with harmful bacteria such as E. coli or salmonella, it potentially can distribute into many, many, many pounds of ground meat, Roger says. Plus, when a steak or chicken breast is contaminated, the bacteria are usually on the surface, where they can be easily killed when cooked. But in ground meat, the bacteria gets mixed throughout. Serve up a medium-rare burger or an undercooked chicken meatball, and you may put people at risk of becoming seriously ill. In addition, as you make a patty or roll a meatball, you may handle ground meat more than a whole cut, Rogers says, so there are more opportunities for bacteria to spread from your hands and prep surfaces to the other foods. E. coli in beef. CR's finding of E. coli in a package of Kroger-branded ground beef purchased at a grocery store in Seattle triggered a rapid recall of products sold at several chains across the West and Southwest. The action happened so quickly for one main reason. The particular strain CR found, E. coli 0157.H7, is the one that USDA takes very seriously. That's because it produces a toxin called Shiga toxin that can harm the intestines, often causing painful, bloody diarrhea, and in 5 to 10% of the cases, potentially fatal kidney damage. The USDA has taken an aggressive approach towards this strain of E. coli in ground beef since the 1990s, after a notorious outbreak linked to undercooked hamburgers at Jack in the Box restaurants. More than 600 people became ill and 4 children died, prompting the agency to declare 0157H7 and later 6 related strains of Shiga toxin-producing E. coli as adulterants. As a result, ground beef for products that contain it, or products that contain it, with those bacteria cannot be legally sold, and manufacturers must recall meat that could be contaminated, even if no illnesses are clearly linked to it. As CR's test found, dangerous E. coli strains still do sometimes show up in ground beef. The recall this year prompted by our test was one of 23 such recalls since 2018, and some people, about 265,000 a year, continue to be sickened by strains. Still, the agency's aggressive approach has helped, says Bill Marler, a Seattle attorney who focuses on food safety cases and represented consumers sickened in the Jack in the Box outbreak. Faced with the expense and bad publicity that comes with recalls, he says, ground meat producers invested heavily in improved testing and production methods. The result is that E. coli 0157 cases essentially were cut in half, he says. And then there's an illustrated piece about why ground meat is so dangerous, and it shows pictures of cows, one of which is obviously infected, and the meat processing plants, and then the procedures. Because the bacteria all animals headed to slaughter carry some bacteria in their guts, but some animals have more and more dangerous strains than others. During processing, meat from some animals may become contaminated and be mixed with meat from other animals when making ground meat. Because the bacteria are mixed through the meat, it's usually only the surface of steaks or chicken parts, the meat needs to be cooked extra carefully to get hot enough to kill the bacteria in the middle. Salmonella in chicken. While the USDA has taken a hard stance on Shiga toxin producing E. coli in ground beef, That's not the case for salmonella in chicken or turkey. That's problematic, says Brian Holholm, director of food policy at Consumer Reports. The agency needs to treat those bacteria, especially in chicken, with a far greater sense of urgency. Salmonella is widespread in chickens, in part because of the often crowded and filthy conditions in which they are raised. Nearly 1.35 million people get sick from the bacteria every year, about five times as many as with harmful E. coli. About a fifth of those come from the chicken and turkey, including ground versions. Reducing those numbers has been a stated public health goal for more than a decade. Yet large number of people sickened by salmonella hasn't changed in years, says Mitzi Braun, CEO at Stop Foodborne Illnesses, a food safety advocacy group. And the USDA, far from declaring zero tolerance for the bacteria, actually allows poultry producers to sell meat that may be contaminated with the bacteria. The agency does require poultry processors to regularly test for salmonella, but a plant is allowed to have salmonella up to 9.8% of whole birds at test, 15.4% in parts, and 25% of ground chicken. And if producers exceed those levels, they are only given what amounts to a warning, not told to stop selling the meat. CR found salmonella in 23 of the 75 samples we tested, almost a third of them. Nine of the 25 products from Purdue, a leading producer of ground chicken with the most samples on our test, had salmonella. Samples from Trader Joe's and Wholesome Pantry, which source their ground chicken from Purdue, also had positive samples, as did some from Esernio's, Walmart, and Whole Foods. Overall, no single brand stood out as being statistically better or worse than another. There is even no difference between ground meat from organic chicken and meat from conventionally raised birds. The message: salmonella in ground chicken is more common than it should be. This is not an isolated or contained problem. Legal but dangerous. If salmonella in chicken is so dangerous and so common, why doesn't the USDA treat it as aggressively as it does Shiga toxin producing E. coli? For one thing, lawsuits brought by the meat industry have made it hard for the agency to declare salmonella an adulterant. And the argument, which courts have upheld, surprisingly centers on how Americans like their beef and chicken cooked. Congress has said that substances can be considered adulterants in food only if they would ordinarily cause a person injury. The courts have determined that it is perfectly ordinary for people to eat beef on the rare side, below the temperature that kills all the E. coli, which means any of the bacteria in the meat are adulterants. By contrast, it is not typical to eat undercooked chicken. So in theory, anyway, salmonella would ordinarily be killed before people eat it. And that may be why salmonella is not considered to be an adulterant in chicken. But that reasoning is flawed. It puts the onus on people to handle chicken with extreme care in their kitchens, not on producers to safely raise and package the meat. It makes the consumers the last safety check in the food, she says, and that is an unknown risk for the consumer. Fixing a broken system. CR shared our ground chicken test results with all the producers who had at least one sample test positive for salmonella and asked them what steps they take to reduce salmonella contamination. Purdue, which has partnered with CR and other food safety groups to push for a more rigorous approach to ensuring meat safety, says that in a recent spot check it did, of 312 samples, only 17, or 5.4%, were positive for salmonella. That's far lower than the 36% of Purdue samples with the bacteria in CR's test. Purdue and several other producers say they are taking steps to reduce salmonella in their products. Tricia Moriarty, a spokesperson for Walmart, says the company began a salmonella interventions program in 2014. While no system will eliminate all salmonella bacteria, our program has significantly reduced the amount in the products it gets from suppliers, she says. Whole Foods says that it is a quality assurance team that assesses salmonella reports from the USDA and that if a processing plant is not meeting our expectations, we investigate to determine the root cause and a corrective action. And Wholesome Pantry says the company holds our suppliers to strict industry standards. Tom Super, Senior Vice President of Communications at the National Chicken Council, an industry group, says that such steps have helped improve meat safety and that some risk is inescapable. Any raw agricultural product, including fresh fruit, vegetables, meat, and poultry, is susceptible to naturally occurring bacteria, he says. No legislation or regulation can keep bacteria from existing. But independent food safety experts say larger, more systemic changes are needed. Lance Price, Ph.D., director of Antibiotic Resistant Action Center at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., since the best solution would be to reduce the number of chickens that carry salmonella in the first place, and for the agency to declare the bacteria to be adulterants. That would require companies to recall any product that tests positive for the bacteria instead of waiting for outbreaks when people get sick. He also acknowledges that such steps are unlikely, at least in the short term. Instead, he, along with CRS Rundum, say that other safety advocates says the USDA should focus on sharply reducing the percentage of chicken samples allowed to test positive for salmonella. In addition, the agency should focus on the most problematic strains of salmonella. Last year, CR, along with the Center for Science and the Public Interest and other food safety groups, petitioned the USDA, urging it to reduce the salmonella strains that pose the biggest threat to human health. The agency identified three strains to focus on: Infantis, Typhimurium, and Enterititis. In CR's test, 91% of the salmonella detected in chicken came from those three strains. The groups also say that USDA needs more authority to inspect facilities that breed and raise poultry, and when a plant is found to have high salmonella rates, to quickly shutter its operations. Sandra Eskin, Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety at the USDA, says the results of Consumer Reports sampling project underscores why the agency is rethinking our existing strategy so that it is more effective in reducing salmonella infections from poultry. She says the agency is gathering recommendations from independent food safety experts and working with the industry to develop pilot projects to test drive different control strategies. When it comes to the Shiga toxin producing E. coli strains, Rundum says they should be addressed aggressively wherever they are found. He says that those strains are now considered adulterants only in ground beef and mechanically tenderized beef. Those are cuts of meat pierced by a machine to make them more tender, a process that can drive bacteria from the surface into the meat. Handle with care. Industry and the government take stronger steps to limit salmonella, E. coli, and other bacteria in meat. The best way to prevent foodborne illness remains practice scrupulous kitchen hygiene. There are some tips from shopping to prep to storing leftovers. At the grocery store, keep raw meats in a disposable bag separated from other foods. This can reduce the chance of contaminated package coming into contact with other foods, especially uncooked foods that are consumed raw, such as fruits and salads. In the fridge, store raw meat in a bag or bowl that keeps juices from leaking into other surfaces or foods. Don't rely on how meat looks or smells. You can't tell whether a meat or poultry contain harmful bacteria. Use ground meat within 2 days of purchase or freeze it. Either it's an original package or repackaged. Either way, wrap it in foil or plastic wrap and put it in a freezer bag or an airtight container. Thaw frozen meat in the refrigerator. That's to keep meat cool below 40 degrees Fahrenheit as it thaws, a temperature that impedes the growth of bacteria. Setting it out on the counter can accelerate that growth. Once the meat is thawed, use it within a day or two for ground meat or any type of poultry, and within 3 to 5 days for cuts of beef or pork. Don't rinse raw meat. Doing so is likely to spread any bacteria around the sink or counter than it is to remove any bacteria. If you like, pat the meat with a paper towel first instead. When preparing, wash, wash, wash. Wash your hands in hot, soapy water before you start prepping, then every time you touch raw meat, and then again when you're finished, and wash any knives used on meat before cutting other foods. Use dedicated cutting boards. This means one's for raw meat and another for fruits and vegetables. Get a meat thermometer and use it. You can't gauge whether meat is fully cooked now by how it looks. Instead, check the internal temperature with a thermometer. Ground beef and pork are safe when cooked to 160 degrees. Poultry ground whole and parts should be cooked to 165. Beef frozen steaks and pork frozen chops to 145. Refrigerate leftovers promptly. Cooked food shouldn't be left out longer than 2 hours after it's removed from the stove, oven, or grill. 1 hour is the limit if you're outside and the temperature is 90 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. Salmonella, widespread in chicken. CR purchased 75 packages of ground chicken at grocery stores across the country. They include samples from producers Bell & Evans, Isernos, Tyson's, Purdue. Those with labels of the stores where they were sold, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods. Some that had no label, Walmart, and some that carried a store brand name, Wholesome Pantry, sold at ShopRite. The chart I'm going to show you shows the number of samples from each brand and store that had three or four more products at our test, as well as the number of samples that tested positive for salmonella. Brands or store with one or two samples are listed as other. The main takeaway, salmonella was common among brands and the stores that we looked at. Bell & Evans did not test any. They had four samples and no salmonella at all. Acerinios had four samples. It tested salmonella on one. Purdue had 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 samples. And these 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 samples came out positive. Trader Joe's had three samples. Two of them tested positive. Tyson's had four samples. None tested positive. Walmart had two samples. I'm sorry, those are the numbers that tested negative. I'm sorry, of the samples. And Walmart tested with four positive. Whole Foods had five tested for negative, and four came out positive. Wholesome Pantry had three negative and two positive, and others had, looks like, about 12 tested negative and one tested positive. So there are some good choices here and not so good choices. Why superbugs are in your meat? CR found adiabatic-resistant bacteria in many of the ground meat samples we tested. Here's how they got there and what you can do to help. Healthy animals are often given antibiotics in their food or water. Bacteria in their intestines react with the antibiotics. Same with the bacteria are killed, but a few survive and multiply. Resistant bacteria can also contaminate raw meat during slaughter or processing. Via plant workers who pick up bacteria on their skin and transfer the meat to other people. Via raw meat in supermarkets, which may contain bacteria. Animals excrete antibiotic-resistant bacteria in manure, and bacteria spreads in several ways. Via air, when the bacteria are carried by wind. Via water, when waste seeps into groundwater. Via flies, which carry bacteria they have picked up on the farm. Via farm workers, who pick up the bacteria on their skin and spread them when they come into contact with other people. And via soil, when animal waste is used to fertilize crops. And following all that, people become ill with antibiotic-resistant infections. CR found salmonella in 23 of the 75 samples of ground chicken we tested. All the salmonella was resistant to at least one antibiotic, and 78% resistant to multiple drugs. We also found antibiotic-resistant bacteria in some samples of ground beef, pork, and turkey. In fact, salmonella strains found in a ground pork sample were resistant to 12 antibiotics, the most in our test. That's concerning for several reasons. For one, people could get sick if they consume undercooked meat, contaminated with those bacteria, or if they handle it and then touch their mouth. And because the bacteria are resistant to antibiotics, the infections can be harder to treat. More than 212,000 people each year are sickened by antibiotic-resistant salmonella in food, and 70 die, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. CR's finding also highlights how misuse of antibiotics on farms contributes to the spread of these superbugs. If an animal is sick and needs antibiotics, it should get them, says Brian Ronholm, Director of Food Policy at CR. But meat producers often give animals low doses to prevent illness. That's one way bacteria evolved to become immune to antibiotics. Some producers have agreed to reduce their use of drugs, and many products have labels saying that meat comes from animals raised without antibiotics. That's a positive step, says Lance Price, director of Antibiotic Resistant Action Center at George Washington University, but doesn't completely solve the problem. In CR's test, 18 of the chicken samples contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria came from birds that were raised without the drugs. Why? Even if they're raised without antibiotics, animals can pick up drug-resistant strains in the environment, Price says. And the crowded, filthy conditions in which chickens and other animals are often raised can make fertile breeding grounds for bacteria. If meat from animals raised without antibiotics can still be contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, is it worth choosing products with no antibiotics labels? Yes, Ronholm says. That supports producers who are at least trying to help solve the problem. It's important to know, though, that such labels might not always be accurate. Price recently did a study involving 699 cattle supposedly raised under a No Antibiotics Ever program, which is regulated by the Department of Agriculture. It found traces of at least one antibiotic in the urine of 15% of the cattle. Here are some ways to increase the chance that the meat you buy really is raised without antibiotics. For all meat, look for the USDA organic seal. To earn that, producers must be inspected at least annually and are subject to surprise visits to ensure that they comply with guidelines. For poultry, look for a USDA process verified program shield. Producers who seek that label submit to administrative audits and on-site inspections to make sure the feed does not contain antibiotics. And for beef, look for the American grass-fed label. Part of the seal's requirements are that cattle aren't given antibiotics. And the last on this particular article is how to make safer burgers. Keep them chilled. Don't take meat out of the fridge until you're ready to make patties. Then refrigerate the patties in just before grilling. That helps prevent any bacteria that may be in the meat from multiplying and can help your patty hold together during cooking. Tip: when forming patties, make a slight indentation of the top of each with your thumb to keep shrinkage to a minimum. Avoid charring. When meat is charred, carcinogenic compounds can form cooking on indirect heat can minimize cooking on indirect heat can minimize that problem. Fire up one side of the grill and cook on the other. Turning frequently helps too. Don't press down. That drains the flavorful juices from the meat. Rest cooked patties on a clean plate or platter for at least 5 minutes before serving, so the juices can stay locked in. Cook them well. You might think you like a hamburger on the rare side, but ground beef has to get to 160 degrees Fahrenheit to kill bacteria. Use a meat thermometer. You can't judge doneness by color. Sorry about that. The cheapest day of the week to do absolutely anything. Plan your week around these major savings, whether you're buying wine, filling up your tank, or going to Disney World. The best days to save. Like the prices of gas and plane tickets, the cost of many products and services change frequently. In the winter, you may get the best deal on patio furniture, on air conditioner installations, while in the summer, you're likely to score huge discounts on winter jackets and skis. And it turns out these pricing fluctuations apply to the days of the week, too. Believe it or not, there's a best day of the week by everything from a bottle of wine to major appliances and even a house. We are crowd advice from financial experts, saving surveys for the best prices on pretty much anything, every single week. Even more tips how to save. The cheapest day to get gas. Gas prices have been through the roof recently, which means you'll want to be strategic about when you fill up. In 2021, research at Gas Buddy found that Monday is the cheapest day to visit the pumps in most states, followed by Friday and Sunday. Whatever you do, never fill up on Wednesday or Thursday. That's when prices are their highest. Though there is variation in daily gas prices across different states, the consensus is that filling up at the beginning or end of the work week on Monday or Friday is the best way to save money, says Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. But even if you can't always time your fill-ups, the golden rule is always shop around before filling up. The cheapest day to buy wine, oh, this is important, although most people host dinner parties on Saturday and Sunday, purchasing wine on those days could cost you. The cheapest day of the week to buy wine or beer is Tuesday or Wednesday, says financial planner Michael Ryan, founder of financial literacy website Michael Ryan Money. This is because most people do not drink wine midweek, so the stores offer their weekly sales to encourage people to come in. If you're looking to bring something a little so that tells you when the best time to buy wine. The cheapest day to go to Disney. When it comes to a cheap trip to Disney, every bit of savings counts. Prices vary quite a bit depending on the day and time of year. But if you can, try to plan your trip for a weekday. In 2022, a one-day weekday pass in September starts at $109. Saturday or Sunday pass, on the other hand, will cost upwards of $139. The cheapest day to buy a house. The day of the week to close a deal on your home could make a huge difference in your savings. Here, Monday and Tuesday reign supreme. This is because most people are working and are not able to view houses during this time, says Ryan. It also is in between the time sellers are excited about new buyers coming during the next weekend and the disappointment of not getting an acceptable offer for the previous weekend. It doesn't hurt that there's generally less interest on weekdays, too. That's interesting because the way the housing market is now, that's probably not completely true. The cheapest day to buy beer. The best day to buy up on six-packs? Monday. All types of alcoholic beverages are at their most expensive from Thursday to Sunday, since they are at their highest demand. And Monday is restock day for the majority of stores, says Carly Suth, CEO of Credit Summit. That means Monday is the day of the lowest demand and highest supply, which is what drives down the price. Need some new beverage suggestions? Try the top craft beers around the country. The cheapest day to fly. Most people leave for vacation on a Friday and return home on Sunday, which is why you definitely don't want to fly on those days. If you're looking for a deal, the cheapest days to fly the friendly skies are Tuesday and Wednesday for domestic and international flights, according to a fair compare study. the cheapest day to book a hotel. When it comes to booking travel, earlier in the week is best. Hotels are at their peak at the end of the week, so you get the best rates by booking at the start of the week, says Sooth. If you book on Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, you'll likely get the cheapest rates. Staying at an all-inclusive resort can also help you stay within your budget. The cheapest day to stay in a hotel. Looking for a one-night staycation? You'll want to book a Sunday night. Most people are leaving their personal travel on this day. From the weekends and business travelers usually don't arrive until Monday or Tuesday night, says Ryan. Due to this, hotels are usually trying to fill their rooms on Sunday night. And the cheapest day to shop for groceries. While specific days of the week are best for saving on specific items, the best overall shopping days are Wednesday and Thursday. Bread and beer are typically marked down on Wednesday, and snacks are often cheapest on Thursdays, according to shopping experts. An added benefit is the store very likely will be less packed midweek than on Saturday or Sunday. Cheapest day to buy a car. You might think that heading to the car dealership on a slow day will make the business more likely to give you a discount, but that's not what research shows. One true car study from 2020 found that the best day to purchase a new car is Sunday, when buyers can save an average of 10% off the MSRP. In states where car sales aren't allowed on Sunday, you'll want to shop on Tuesday. The day you'll get the least amount of savings? Thursday. The cheapest day to buy a laptop. Manufacturers that sell items such as cell phones, video games, televisions, and laptops often release rebates and discounts on Mondays, according to the Crazy Coupon Lady, which makes Monday the winning day for these purchases. You'll also want to keep your eyes peeled on sale holidays like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, President's Day, and Amazon Prime Day. The cheapest day to eat out with your kids? The only thing better than eating out for free, and if you have kids, that's totally possible, many restaurants offer kids-eat-free nights when you get a free kid's meal with the purchase of an adult entree. The most common day of the week to find these deals? Tuesday. Chick-fil-A, Denny's, and TGI Fridays all offer them. And let's close out with a couple of life in these United States. The guy in front of me in the grocery store with checkout line was buying just three things, a case of beer, a carton of cigarettes, and a gallon of milk. The total came to $75. He stood there for a moment in disbelief before asking the cashier, "How much was that milk?" I've been running for more than half of my life and admits it possible that I've slowed down a step or two. Recently, I was grinding up a steep hill when I passed a 77-year-old neighbor in his driveway. "Nice day for a walk," he said. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so very much for listening.